You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of six lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Spiritual Life Now and After Death, Forming Our Destiny in the Physical and Spiritual Worlds, Collected Works, Volume 157A. This is Lecture 2, The Formation of Destiny, given on November 18, 1915. My first sad and heavy duty is to inform you that our dear friend, the leader of the Munich Lodge, Miss Stinde, now belongs to those whom we have to reckon today as the, quote, sphere beings, close quote. She left this physical plane yesterday evening. It is not possible just now to speak about this extremely severe and significant loss to our society. As a beginning to our consideration for today, I will merely say these few words concerning this event which is so painful and important to us. Miss Stinde belongs to those who are well known to most of our friends. She belongs to those who have comprehended our matters in the deepest depths of their hearts, and have identified themselves completely with them. In her house and that of her friend, the Grafin Kalkreuth, as early as 1903, I was able to give the first intimate lectures in our area, which I had to give in Munich. One may say that from this first occasion, when Miss Stinde approached us, she united not only her whole personality with our aims, but also the whole power of her work, so valuable, so excellent and influential. She forsook the artistic calling that was previously so dear to her, in order to put herself and her powers entirely at the service of our work. And since then she has worked intensely for this, in a rare, objective, quite impersonal manner, both in narrower and wider circles. She was the soul of our whole work in Munich. Moreover, she was one of those souls of whom one could say that through the inner qualities of her being, she gave the very best guarantee that in Munich itself, our aims would be able to develop in the best possible manner. You know what an immense task was laid on all those persons helping in Munich in those early years, through the performances of the mystery plays and everything connected with them. Miss Stinde and her friend Grafin Kalkreuth gave themselves up absolutely to this work, and above all, it may be said, with the understanding created by the profound nature of their studies, and by the will that may itself be born of this. I may perhaps point out that the intense labor that Miss Stinde accomplished really very considerably exhausted her life strength in later years. It must be admitted that the valuable life force that was perhaps too rapidly used up of late was devoted to our cause, in the most beautiful and deeply satisfactory manner. Probably no one among those who knew her most intimately could help feeling that this personality was one of our very best workers. It is true that many of Miss Stinde's activities have been misunderstood, and it is to be hoped that the sun-like force that proceeded from her personality will presently be recognized, even by those of our friends and followers who through prejudice have misunderstood her work, and those of our wider circle who could observe all she did for our cause, will, in common with those more closely connected with her, preserve the most faithful recollection of her. We are sure that in her case we may quite especially emphasize the mantra that must often be uttered during these days in connection with the departure of many of our friends from the physical plane. It may be emphasized especially with Miss Stinde that amid the many attacks and oppositions that our cause encounters in the world, We reckon on the help of those in the spiritual world. We reckon on those who have only changed the form of their existence, and who, in spite of their passage through the gate of death, are still truly united with us in soul, and our most significant and important co-workers. The many veils that surround those still incarnate in the physical body gradually fall away, and the souls of these dear departed friends, of this we are sure, work in our midst, and we especially need their help. We need the help of those no longer assailed from the physical plane, those who have no longer to consider the limits of the physical plane. If we have the deep and earnest belief in the success of our cause in the civilization of the world, it is because we have the full consciousness that those who formerly belonged to us are still our best forces, that they work among us from the spiritual world with spiritual means. The trust in our cause that we require will often be strengthened by the knowledge that we must thank our departed friends for being in our midst, so that by uniting our forces with theirs, we can accomplish the labor that is laid upon us for the spiritual civilization of the world. I should now like to continue the considerations that we began to develop in our last lecture. Such times as our own, in which the enigma of death approaches the human soul in so many different forms, and on this we laid stress in our last lecture, urge us quite especially to investigate what human beings are certainly able to acquire regarding the spiritual world. Times like our own, in which humanity is exposed to such severe trials, are destined for the very purpose of leading the human soul to inquire as to the beings of the spiritual world. For who does not see at each step in what is happening today, and is happening in the greater part of the civilized world, who does not see at almost every stage the great mystery of life confronting them? And who does not feel that great connections lie concealed behind such events as those occurring around us today, and as they occur, convulse our souls and hearts with pain and sorrow, while filling them also with hope and confidence? Certainly, whoever beholds the events of the world with but a short-sighted vision will judge such far-reaching events by those that immediately precede and follow them. But one who externally, without entering into esoteric considerations, regards the course of cosmic events and compares earlier times with the present, will become conscious of how very much may be connected first with that, let us say, which in quite a different manner runs its course later on in the cosmos, as effect. Consider how many people there are now who say that the present events of war are merely the results of external political opposition among the various nations and peoples. This is certainly true, and there is no question of presenting anything in objection to the truth of such a concept in a limited sense. However, if we consider, for example, the wars waged in the beginning of the Middle Ages between the Central European peoples and those of Southern Europe, and above all the populations of the Roman Empire, we must note that the wars that occurred then in political strife also arose from the opposition, the political opposition, that existed at the time. They had the causes in those conflicts in their immediate locality. These battles have now run their course. They have evoked certain configurations in the whole life of Europe. If we investigate but a little into history and consider what happened at that time to the battles of the Central European peoples, with, let us say, the peoples of the Roman Empire, we shall come to the conclusion that out of the earlier configuration of the European world, there has arisen a later one. But if we wish to estimate correctly the real point at issue, we must consider all the historical results. For these historical results that have occurred in Europe could not have arisen as they have if those battles had ended the other way? And what was the consequence of this European history? The whole manner in which Christianity spread and grew in Europe is the result of it. And if we consider these deep connections, we can say that in all that happened in the following centuries, the facts lie thus. The events of these centuries are karmically connected with their causes, the battles of those times. That means that the events to which we have alluded are connected with the later configuration of the European world in its entirety, even in its spiritual relations. Just consider that in all its gravity, and you will admit that Christianity then spread in Europe and so fashioned itself that through the youthful Germanic peoples opposing the Roman peoples, who had now grown old, and through the uniting of their youthful forces with what flowed into humanity as the announcement of Christianity, a certain European atmosphere was thereby created, into which the souls descending later were born. Thus, the souls lived and developed in the following centuries, in accordance with these events. Therefore, we may say, if an individual at that time had asserted, quote, "How does that affect things? It is merely a political opposition between the nations of South and Central Europe," close quote, quote, that person would be right. But if another had said, quote, "Just look, the configuration of the spiritual civilization of all the following centuries will result from what is happening," close quote, that person also would be right, and in a much deeper sense. If we seek the immediate causes of anything by pointing to the opposing forces nearest at hand, we do not therewith touch on the entire gravity of the occurrence. The affairs of this world are all very intimately connected. And if we require inner strengthening in order, as it were, to find the right forces for the support of our work, we need only remind ourselves that in a still smaller circle than our present one were once seated together those who, when Christianity was first announced, represented its great cosmic truths. I have already often used this comparison, but we shall apply it yet again today. There was a time that we can describe as follows. We see the old Roman Empire. We see it with its old philosophy. We see it living entirely in the atmosphere of the old heathen philosophy. We see this empire with the people who, in a sense, formed the upper classes. And there, below, truly more underneath than our under signifies today, literally underneath, in the catacombs underground, we see the first small handful of Christians, possessing something quite foreign to the world culture up above, but that they carried so deeply in their hearts that its force became truly cosmically creative. Let us picture these catacombs. There, underneath, in the catacombs, with their thoughts directed to the Christ impulse, were the first Christians, and above, over their heads, the Romans, who behaved quite differently from the first Christians. You know all that. I need not relate it further. But if you picture 2 centuries later, how different everything appears. What was above is swept away, and what was venerated underground in secret has found its way to the surface. Certainly the times and the forms in which such things occur change, but the essential remains. Concerning those who today advocate the external scientific and spiritual culture, it may be said, though this is not to be taken literally, that they feel themselves above and call what is striven for in our circles the philosophy of a few sectarians derived from a few abnormal minds. But whoever really penetrates the nature of these conceptions of ours, and who above all permeates themselves with them, may have the assurance that here too some day what is kept under will be on the top. Here, then, our thoughts may dwell on the transformed world that will arise out of these difficult times of ours, on the spiritual that humankind must learn to grasp. For there hardly exists a greater similarity in historical evolution than that between our own times and what played its part in the epoch when the old Roman culture was still above, and Christianity, tended by a few faithful souls, was still below. I would like to point out, if I may do so without seeming narrow-minded, through a too exact and pedantic reference to these things, for in these days we should be very broad indeed, that it is especially good to hold before the soul, as imaginative pictures, our own epoch and that of Rome at the first appearance of Christianity. Now, many who today oppose what we call spiritual science cannot fail to feel the entirely different nature of what spiritual science must advocate in contradistinction to what is otherwise upheld among the so-called normal people of today. And here we need only observe, if we wish to understand this correctly, how the first announcement of Christianity was completely opposed to what was upheld among the Romans, the normal people of those times. With such a thought we must make ourselves acquainted, for it is again and again leveled against us that with the accepted means of cognition, humanity cannot reach worlds such as those with which we are concerned. We must really so grasp the more intimate work in our groups as to be able to say, this life in our groups is not useless. It is not without significance to this cause of ours that we should meet together in such groups and again renew not only acquaintance with the theoretical results of our doctrine, which is not of importance, but also renew our warm feelings and sensations for the actual things and beings of the spiritual world. Thereby we accustom ourselves to that manner of psychic sensing and feeling that above all makes it possible for us to take up spiritual truths in a different way from those who are unprepared. In our group meetings, there must occasionally be imparted to you something from the higher and later parts of spiritual knowledge. We cannot always start afresh from the beginning. But this intimacy within the life of the groups must make it possible for a number of our friends to take into themselves, into their souls, such things as I pointed out in the last lecture, namely, the special manner of verifying our spiritual knowledge and of taking it into oneself. We cannot verify these things in the same manner as people do in the external world, when they contact things with their eyes. But those who have a feeling for such facts, as I pointed out last time, will, even if they do not themselves see into the spiritual world, feel that through the mutual support of spiritual truths, the value of these truths is intensified. Therefore, I shall yet again draw attention to the very significant fact that on the one side, through many years of study, the definite point of view is reached, that a third of our life between birth and death, in time, is again lived through after death, while now on the other side a quite different point of view is discovered, namely, that in reality we experience our sleep life in a special form during the time we call Kamaloka. And that this time also occupies a third of the life on the physical plane. These two points of view are quite independent of each other and have been discovered from different starting points. We have also shown on other occasions how from three or four different points of view, one always comes to the same conclusion. Thus do the truths support each other. But for this we must ourselves acquire the right feeling. This will produce something like a natural elemental feeling for the truth of this spiritual knowledge. I must often appeal to this, otherwise I would not give out the later and higher truths in the various group meetings. Last time we drew attention to the fact that the right connection of our eye consciousness between death and rebirth is, as it were, kindled through that panoramic review of our last earthly life that takes place after death, we go over our life again in a kind of tableau. You must quite clearly understand what a person there really beholds. We are here accustomed to stand on the physical plane, becoming in a sense a kind of central point of our cosmic horizon. And we see the world around us that makes an impression on our senses. In normal life, on the physical plane, we do not look into ourselves. We turn our gaze outward. Now, if we want to form an idea of the life immediately following death, it is important to keep in mind that this gaze on the panorama of life is absolutely different from the perception we are accustomed to using on the physical plane. On the physical plane, we look out of ourselves and regard the world as our environment. Quote, "We are here, we look outward, and not into ourselves." Close quote. Immediately after death, we have a few days in which our field of vision is filled with what we have undergone between birth and death. We then look within, from the circumference to the center. We regard our own life in its chronological course. Whereas we usually say, quote, "Here are we, and everything else is outside us," close quote, immediately after death we have the consciousness that this distinction between us and the world does not exist. For we look from the circumference on to our own life, which for these few days is our world. In ordinary perception on the physical plane, we behold hills, houses, rivers, trees, etc. So, in the same way, we see what we have undergone in life from a certain personal perspective as our own immediate world. And because we see it, that gives the starting point for the maintenance of the I through the entire life between death and rebirth. It is what strengthens and invigorates the soul, so that between death and rebirth it always knows, quote, "I am an I," close quote. Here, in physical life, we realize our I through the fact, which I have often pointed out, that we stand in a certain relation to our body. Consider this. If you reflect closely on a dream, you will say, in the dream you have no clear feeling of the I, but often a feeling of separation. That is because human beings here on the physical plane only really feel their I through contact with their body. You can represent it very crudely thus. If you move your finger through the air, there is nothing there. Move it further, and there is still nothing. When you touch something, however, in coming against something, you know of yourself. You become aware of yourself. We are thereby made aware of our I. Not the I itself is aroused, the I is a being, but the consciousness of the I. The opposition makes us aware of ourself. Thus we are I-conscious in the physical body because of our living in it. For this reason we have received the physical body. In the life between death and rebirth, we have an I-consciousness, because we have received the forces that proceed from the vision of the previous life. We come to a certain extent in contact with what the world of space gives us, and thereby win our I-consciousness for the life between birth and death. We come in contact with what we ourselves have experienced between birth and death in the last life, and thereby have our I-consciousness for the life between death and rebirth. There now follows the quite different life that occupies a third of the time of the life between birth and death, and that is usually called the Kamaloka life. This life follows. It is of such a nature that we may say a widening of our vision appears. While during the first few days our vision is really directed only to ourself, to our past life, not to the personality, this, as time goes on, becomes quite different. Certainly the power of knowing oneself as an I remains, but there now appears, and you can gather for yourselves from the lectures and books what I am about to say, there now appears something quite peculiar, to which humans have first to accustom themselves, because the whole method of perceiving in that world is quite different from what it is here on the physical plane. A great part of what people have to undergo after death consists of inwardly accommodating themselves to a different mode of perception. Here we have nature around us. What we here regard in the physical world as nature is absolutely non-existent in that world that is ours between death and rebirth. To see nature here, we have our physical eyes, ears, and the whole physical apparatus of perception. And this nature, as it exists, with its fullness of color and other characteristics, could not be perceived by other different organs of perception. Therefore, we are endowed with a physical body, that we may be able to perceive nature. After death, in the place of what is here around us as nature, we have around us the spiritual world, that we describe as the world of the hierarchies and world of pure being, of pure soul, not matter or substance or objects that have color, but pure being. That is the essential point. Therefore, naturally, the astonishment is greatest for those souls who denied the spirit while here in physical life. For those who deny the spirit and believe nothing of the spiritual are placed in a world that they have denied, and that is completely unknown to them. They are compelled to live in a world whose existence they actually refused to acknowledge. We are therefore surrounded by a spiritual environment of pure being or pure soul. Now, souls gradually emerge, forming themselves from this universal soul world, because there are, at first, souls everywhere, souls we do not recognize. We know they are all souls, but we do not recognize them individually. But gradually individual souls appear more distinctly and concretely. Especially those souls appear at this time with whom we have lived here on the physical plane, the souls of those with whom we have lived here. While we face this fullness of souls, we learn with whom we are among. This soul is so-and-so, that soul is someone else, and so on. We make acquaintance with these souls. First, we must recognize that the whole relation in which we stand to the world then, between death and rebirth, is essentially different, in yet other respects, to the relation in which we stand here on the physical plane. Here, we say that the world is outside us. After death, we have really the consciousness that the world is within us. Just imagine that for a moment here on the earth you were to dissolve entirely, that you were to vanish into vapor. The vaporous cloud that is you spreads out more and more, and only ceases to spread farther when it reaches the firmament. It expands, but cannot continue. Consider for a moment the firmament as a being. You then feel yourself as this firmament. And now, see everything within it. Thus you stand outside with your consciousness and see the world inside. You feel yourself in such a way that everything that appears is within you. Just as here a pain is inside us, in like manner after death, beings appear in us as inner experience. That brings about the infinite intimacy of the experiences between death and rebirth. The fact of being so bound together with them that we actually have them as our own inner experiences. And here there is a certain distinction. Consider such a soul as I have instanced, which one begins to recognize, and of which all one can know at first is, quote, yes, it is there, but it has no form, it is not yet perceptible, but it is there, close quote. To make it perceptible, we have to accomplish an inner activity somewhat as follows. Imagine ourselves placed in the spiritual world. If I feel something behind me that I do not see, the idea arises in me that it is there. But I must act in some way to gain some concept of it. I may say it is similar to touching something to gain an idea of it. this inner activity is necessary if the imagination is to appear. I know the being is there, but I must first create an imagination by uniting myself inwardly with that being. That is the one way that human beings can perceive souls. Another way is that we do not accomplish this inner activity ourselves with such intensity, but that it arises independently, without our having much to do with it. It is somewhat like our perception of something here, but of course it is transferred into the spiritual. And this distinction can exist between two souls. Of the one, people receive a perception through being very active themselves. Of the other, through an imagination arising out of itself. You only need be attentive to recognize this distinction. If you become acquainted with a soul that requires more activity to be perceived, that is the soul of one who has died. But a soul that appears more of its own accord is a soul that is incarnate here on the earth in a physical body. These distinctions are really there. A human being stands, with a few exceptions, which we can mention at the proper time, in union after death both with the souls who have died and those who are still here on earth. And the distinction lies in people's knowing what kind of soul they have to deal with. They know they must be active or passive, according to the way in which there arises the imagination of the soul that they face. Now, there is one idea, one characteristic, which has indeed been expressed many times already, but that we will once more bring forward in connection with the life that occupies a third of the earthly life just elapsed, and that we are accustomed to call the life in Kamaloka. If we are living here on earth and somebody strikes you, you are aware of it. You perceive it and say, "That person struck me." As a rule, it makes a difference whether somebody hits you or whether you hit that person. And if you hear something said by someone, you have not the same experience as when you yourself say something. All this is quite reversed during Kamaloka life, when we live our life backward between death and rebirth. To use this rough illustration, it is then as follows. If you have given anybody a blow in life, you feel what the other person felt through the blow. If you have injured another through a word, you experience the feeling you caused that person. Thus you feel the experience of the other soul. In other words, you experience the results brought about by your own deeds. We experience in this journey backward everything that other people have experienced through us during our life here, between birth and death. If you have lived here between birth and death with many hundreds of people, these people have experienced something through you. But here in physical life, we cannot feel what those others felt and experienced through us. We experience only what they make us go through. After death, this is reversed, and it is essential that we experience everything in this review that others have suffered through us. Thus we undergo the effects of the last earthly existence, and the task of these years really lies in experiencing them. Now, while we are undergoing these effects, the experience is transformed in us into forces. And it happens as follows. Suppose I have offended a man, and he has suffered bitterly as a result. During Kamaloka, I now experience this bitterness myself. I go through it as my own experience. And while I now experience it, it makes good in me the force that must work as opposition. That is, while I undergo this bitterness, I create in myself the force to wipe away from the world this bitterness. I thus realize all the effects of my deeds, and thereby absorb the force to wipe them away. And during this time in Kamaloka, which lasts a third of the earthly life, I absorb all the forces that may be expressed as an intense longing in the now disembodied soul to remove everything that destroys perfection by retarding the soul's evolution. If you ponder this, you will see that people themselves make their own karma. That is, they have in themselves the wish to become such that everything undesirable may be wiped out. Thus is karma prepared during this particular time. We incorporate into our souls the force that we must take up between death and rebirth in order to bring about in the next incarnation that configuration of our life that we are able to regard as the right one. This is how karma is created. In order to understand these things aright, not only theoretically, but so to grasp them that they may penetrate deeply into our forces of willing, of feeling and willing, we must be clear that the whole mode of feeling common to the dead is absolutely different from that of the living. The living may very easily say, quote, "I pity this or that dead man because he has to suffer something from which he cannot escape," close quote. But suppose he has terribly wronged another and can do nothing to put it right. You may perhaps feel sorry for the dead man, but that is quite uncalled for, because he desires nothing more than to be able to evolve the forces whereby he can balance the wrong. That is the very thing that he regards as precious. You would thus be wishing that he should not reach what he himself most longs for. To attain this, he must undergo all the aforesaid suffering. But the positive develops out of the negative. Through insight into what we have done, we develop the power of making compensation. Thus we may say that at the end of this Kamaloka period, individuals have already determined, in accordance with their last life and its recapitulation, how they will enter the next incarnation in their existence, and in what relation they will stand to this or that person in order to compensate this or that. There we actually determine our karma for the life we are to enter. The first part of our time is spent in assimilating from the spiritual world the forces through which we can build up humanity in general, and through which we can form for ourselves a body suitable for our own individuality. First we have the plan of our karma. Then we must fashion the human body to this end. That requires a much longer time and takes place later on. Now, you can see from this that the essential of the time in Kamaloka lies in the fact that it gives us the possibility of ethically preparing our next incarnation in the right manner. We must be quite clear that each following incarnation depends on the earlier ones. We see how our following incarnations are prepared. And we see that the entire mode of people's lives depends on the way in which they went through their former lives. The objection is raised by persons who have not yet fully considered the matter that this contradicts a person's freedom. I will return to this later. It does not contradict freedom. If we thus observe individual persons in life, we find that they are very, very different. No matter how many people there are on earth, they are all different. Yet one may distinguish categories. There are, for instance, those who so behave that from their earliest youth we can see that as individuals they are especially suited for this or that. As you know, there are such people. Even in childhood, we can predict that they will accomplish some definite purpose. They thrust themselves into it, as it were. They possess activity. They have a special task, because they develop force for this end. Others we find who are interested in many things, but have no definite inclination to any one thing. They take up many things. Perhaps later in life they may come to a definite task that is not especially suited to them. They might perhaps have been able to do something else quite as well. In short, people are quite different, one from another, in reference to the way in which they act in life. And this makes life possible. There are those, for example, who enter life and seem to have little to do outwardly, but they need speak only a word or two to have an influence on people. Such people work more through their inner being. Others work more externally. This is connected intimately with the way they have lived through their previous incarnation. There are those who die in early youth, before the age of 35, to have these very limitations. With regard to their death in this incarnation, such people are in a different position from those who die after the age of 35. Those dying before the age of 35 still exist closer to the world from which they descended at birth. This 35th year forms an important boundary, one that then crosses a bridge, as it were. The world from which people have descended then withdraws, and they produce a new spiritual world from their inner being. It is important for us to distinguish this. Consider people who die before the age of 35. On reincarnating, forces develop in them that they did not use in the years that would have followed their 35th year. Such people who go through death before their 35th year in this way in one incarnation thereby economize for the next incarnation certain forces that would have been exhausted had they lived to the age of 50, 60, or 70. The forces that they saved in this way are added to those with which they incarnate in the next life. In this way, such souls are born into bodies through which they are able to confront life with strong impressions, especially in their youth. In other words, when such souls who died before the 35th year in their last incarnation reincarnate, everything makes a strong impression on them. They are deeply stirred by things. They enjoy things deeply. They have living feelings and are easily urged to impulses of will. They are the people who take a strong position in life and who have real purpose. People do not die without cause before their 35th year. Thus, they receive a very definite purpose in their next life. These things are complicated. Death before the age of 35 may also bring about other things. It is not absolute law, and these are merely examples. However, when people die after 35, it happens that in their next life they do not receive such strong impressions from the things in their surroundings. They cannot easily be stirred or roused. They become acquainted more slowly but more intimately with things, and they thus prepare themselves for a life in their next incarnation in which they will work more through their inner nature, without being so definitely guided to a special task in life. They will so stand in life that they would perhaps have preferred some other task, and are diverted from it in order to accomplish something perhaps absolutely against their will. Because through the previous incarnation on earth they had accustomed themselves to work more delicately, they can now be used in a wider sphere. And if those, I already mentioned this case earlier, are led in very early youth through the gate of death, let us say in the 11th, 12th, or 13th year of life, they then have but a short time in Kamaloka, but they remain very, very near the world that they forsook at physical birth. Everything appears different. After a life ending with the 12th year, there follows the usual retrospect during the first days after death, but it takes place in such a manner that it appears more from outside. Whereas, if people die at the age of 50, 60, or 70, they themselves must do much more to bring about this retrospect. It must be brought about by their own activity. And because they have to experience this life after death in so many various ways, individuals are thereby differently prepared for their next life. It may be that in one life a man is especially active. Now, if an especially active man is summoned from life at an early age, it would then occur that in his next life his karma would appoint him to a quite definite task in life, which he would certainly accomplish. He would be as if predestined. If, however, a man is especially active in one life and lives to a good old age, these forces are then intensified inwardly. He has then in his next life a more complicated task. Outer activity withdraws, and there appears in the soul the necessity to evolve inner activity. thus the life of a human being is complex as it develops from incarnation to incarnation. We shall continue these considerations in the next lecture. Now, I should like to conclude by saying one thing. When you face a whole epoch such as ours, in which in a relatively short time an exceptional number of people are led in abnormal fashion to the gates of death, then, through this, something quite exceptional is being prepared. And it was necessary that this should be prepared. You see each year how the time of blossoming comes to the world in intervals. If you look back in history, you can also say that even there the blossoms appear at intervals. A great time of blossoming was the epoch of Lessing, Herder, Schiller, Fichte, and Goethe. It is as if there were then a gathering of geniuses for a time, and it then ceased. Thus the world progresses in leaps. Such intervals of genius are recorded, and then these things change again. In the spiritual realms, too, we have a blossoming, a special sprouting at intervals. Now, in our days, we have an interval of decay in the physical realm. Here, you have again two things that you can place as pictures, side by side, and that as pictures are tremendously significant. Great physical decay is the seed for a later significant spiritual blossoming. Things have always two sides. From this perspective, ever seeking again and again force and consolation, but also gaining confidence in our hopes, let us once more repeat in reference to our times, and from the consciousness of our spiritual science, quote, from the fighter's courage, from the blood of battles, from the mourner's suffering, from the people's sacrifice, there will ripen fruits of spirit if, with consciousness, the soul turns her thought to spirit realms. The end of Lecture 2.